Hello everyone, I'm Matt Berry. This is the second episode of a series of conversations with Jean-Michel Jarre at his studio in Paris. Today, we'll be talking about oxygen. So this, because we've spoken about this before, there's no demos, is there, for what you did with oxygen? Because you would just rub them out and then start again, as it were.
Yes.
And was it at this time that you met your collab, Michael Geese? Was that
yes, yeah.
Here? And how did you meet him and what part did he play?
He was a technician, maintenance technician at the very famous French record company at that time called Barclay. And now it has been bought by Universal, I think. And then I met him because he was very interested into electronic instruments. And he did one early demonstration of the R2600 in Paris. And then I met him there. And then he was, because he was making his demonstration, owning this instrument. At that time, it was quite expensive. And then he went to my place, and then we started to experiment with this, because it was difficult to afford it also, because it was really in the early days of this instrument. And then I started to work with him. I mean, and also he was teaching me to use this kind of first semi-modular synth I could put my hands on. And then step by step, we worked together, and mainly as a kind of sound engineer. And he was, for Oxygen, for instance, he was working at his record company as a maintenance guy during the day, and he was coming at night. So because I was working at night and also on the day, he was joining me, and then cleaning and recording, and we started like this, the thing I had prepared during the day.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is also very interesting about the fact that in those days I had this kind of probably the first home studio in France, where, because in those days the serious music was done in serious recording studios with a window, where God was the sound engineer behind the window, and we were just on the other side as musicians. And where, of course, for electronic music you need to match the mixing area with the main studio to record your own sounds. And then I did this home studio in a kitchen in the flat I had in Paris. And he was joining me, and we had one of the first 8-tracks tape recorder. Because before, all the production you were mentioning before, I did that in a very unusual way. I was 4 Revoxes.
Yeah.
For 2 tracks, and you couldn't synchronize them. But I noticed that if you record something on one Revox, keeping the same reel, and then you play it with the same reel and with the same instrument, I mean, it's not really shifting before four minutes. And then I had just one thing that Michel Guest, did, and it's just to one having synchronized the 4 play mode at the same time. And then by just like a DJ would do later on, I was just slowing down some of this to try to get the 8 tracks done by 4 tape recorders in sync. And I could play until 4 minutes like this.
And then it would go out.
I did lots of productions. I did the soundtrack for Le Grange Brûlé like this. I did lots of very serious, very serious recordings like this. And then at last, I could afford one of the first 8 tracks. And as you said, which is something that people don't realize in days, that you can archive everything on hard drive.
Yeah.
You can just do everything, anything record everything. I had only one tape. So I had no choice. By if I was not happy with something, I would erase what I've done the previous day. So the reason why I have no archive.
It's such
with
a shame.
Oxygen.
It's such a shame.
So I had to redo, I had actually two tapes. Yeah. And that is the reason why that if you take the master tape, it's very funny because you have, and that was crazy when you think of it, because I, right in the middle of the part one of Oxygen, I had one piece I really liked. This suddenly in the first part, you have this kind of brassy, quite epic brassy moment. This is coming from another tape that I recorded another time. I said that it's really matching very well. And then I did this very strong edit, quite dramatic edit by cutting this and then and mixing those two tapes. And even the colors are different. One is pink in the middle of the black, gray, black tape. It's totally crazy. And you can't hear the edit and on a non-rhythmic part. It's quite a challenging to cut like this on an 8-track. And then Michel Guest was coming, and then step by step, I asked him to do, to conceive some instruments. In those days, it was before MIDI. So I had to play most of the time sequences by hand. And that is coming from the very kind influence I had from Terry Riley. Because when I was still at college, I went into a quite famous studio, even in the UK, called the Chateau d'Hérouville, where lots of bands such as Pink Floyd and the early recording they were doing the recording there. First, because it was a very good studio, it's outside Paris, and second, for tax reasons also.
Okay.
Maybe first tax reasons, and then because it was a good studio. And then I went there as an assistant to work in the studio. And I worked and collaborated with some of Terry Riley's sessions. And I worked with Terry Riley for to prepare that. I was absolutely amazed by watching this guy. I mean, Terry, I mean, just sitting on the floor with his own carpet and then playing all organs around him with echo chambers and things around and doing all the sequences by hands. So he could play. It was he's one of the father of minimalist music and with
Steve.
So you
saw him do that before you started?
Exactly.
Right,
that,
okay.
That is something that probably influenced me by saying, okay, but after a while I said, okay, we should have a kind of sequencer.
Yeah.
That you could, and then he built the first, actually probably one of the first in the world, first they're called Matrix sequencer with a very unusual kind of pre-MIDI type of sync code. I don't know, for obscure reasons, it took us always half a day to synchronize this bloody machine to anything else. But it worked.
Yeah.
And the beauty of it is actually it was like the VCS3, because that was my idea to the matrix. I always love this kind of matrix with pins. And then the matrix sequencer is based on this philosophy or this idea of having, it's a 64 by 16 huge matrix board where you have all the notes vertically. And then all the events horizontally.
Yeah.
And the beauty of it is you can loop by putting another pin on the top of this machine. It's there. I will show it to you later.
Yeah.
Later on. And then you can actually having this sequence and you can make these sequences evolving live by just changing the pins on the way when it's playing. And that changed my life. But actually, that we really went.
So when
Equinox.
Was that? When?
At the end of Oxygen, it was too late to use it. So I most of the sequences from Oxygen are coming from things I played by hand.
And the RMI.
The arpeggiator from the AKS.
Yeah.
Really strange with this blue flat keyboard. This was really, really difficult to handle. And just a very simple arpeggiator coming from a very important instruments in Oxygen and Equinox and also magnetic fields called the RMI harmonic synthesizer. It was the first additive synthesis, like an organ, where you can just add harmonics.
Well, it was harmonics. A digital synth, it's called.
Digital synth.
Yeah.
It was actually kind of semi-digital, but and then you had this kind of way of arpeggiator where you can just push a button and then it will repeat the note. So by doing a chord, you will repeat that. And that Oxygen 5 is done with this. And and then, so I really had actually no sequencer, just basic arpeggiator plus playing the sequences on by hand. And then when you were wrong, you had to go back to scratch. You couldn't, you know, you had to replay the old section. So it was quite heavy process to do. Yeah. And actually, I always had a lot of respect for all these fantastic musicians, Terry Riley and then Steve Reich and Philip Glass. I mean, because they created this minimalist movement, which in my opinion, for me, has been much more influential for contemporary music than the European contemporary music, where lost themselves somewhere in wanting to be too abstract and too extreme. I mean, I remember when I was in the Music Research Center that Xenakis came for a masterclass, and he was saying things like, you know, guys, everything in music linked with emotions or feelings is suspect, and things like this. Some of these musicians, I mean, in those days published books saying, if you follow my system, you always do good music for the rest of your life. I mean, things as extreme as that. And then they lost themselves in being too abstract and too intellectual, where the modern contemporary music of the same, more or less the same period in New York, for me is much more linked to what avant-garde is all about. Because what avant-garde is all about is actually linked to the fact that it becomes classical 30 years later.
Yeah.
I mean, Stravinsky was avant-garde, and then 30 years later, he's become classic. And the same for Charlie Parker or anybody.
Suspect is a really interesting word to use, though, isn't it?
Because it's not bad.
Suspect.
Yeah.
I mean, look, they're applying a rule book.
Yeah.
In a way. That's where it starts to become. I mean, you mentioned fascist, but it's kind of leaning that way. Once you start to tell people how they should make art, then...
Yeah, you start to be suspect.
You start to be suspect. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you know, and what is interesting with avant-garde is actually most of the time I was saying 30 years later, it's becoming classic. But when you listen to the avant-garde music of this period, 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, it's not the music of the 21st century. It's a music really part of a very precise period.
Yeah.
When you listen to this music, it's much more linked to the Atomium of Brussels, of Le Corbusier, of this kind of period in history, rather than being the classical music of today. Where minimalism, like Steve Reich or Philip Glass or Terry Riley, these kind of sequences and repetitive hypnotic type of experimentations are much more linked with what we are doing today.
Yeah. So this is environment in terms of where you record is important to you. I know that. And this is a question that I've always wanted to ask you. So imagine that you would have recorded Oxygen in a professional recording studio with, like you say, somebody behind the glass and you in front with all your instruments, with, say, 16 tracks as opposed to 8, which you did it with. What would that have sounded like?
It couldn't have been possible, I think.
Mm.
It would have been something else. But even more than that, I think it couldn't have been done, because, I mean, the charm, in a sense, or maybe the specific approach, or the specific aspect of Oxygen, is especially because it has been done the way it has been done. I've always been convinced, and more convinced in my life, that actually the environment and the technology are dictating styles, not the reverse. I mean, African music sounds the way it sounds because they are doing instruments with woods and animal skins and for percussions and Vivaldi did the music he has done because just before we invented the violin, without the violin, Vivaldi won't exist. Elvis, the songs won't exist if we didn't have 78 just able to cut 3-minute songs. So the single as a format and is coming from the jukeboxes and 78 and so on. And it's the same with synthesizers and electronic instruments. So in my case for Oxygen, the fact that I was in this environment with this small, I mean, the kitchen being, it's funny because I've always been linked with being born in Lyon, and for me, the kitchen is quite important.
Yeah.
I mean, and also I always, since Oxygen, even before, considered electroacoustic music like an electronic music, like cooking beats, loops, frequencies, and waveforms and all that. And also the instruments. I had so few instruments at that time. I had the Eminent yeah. with a small stone. I had RMI, I mean, harmonic synthesizer with Electric Mistress, another pedal.
Farfisa.
Yes, and the ARP 2600 and the VCS3. It was already lots of electronic instruments for the time,
yeah.
but it was very minimalist.
So it couldn't have happened in any other environment. And if you'd have been offered that sort of opportunity to record it in a studio with someone watching you all the time you're doing it, and you know how normal albums are recorded, I suppose.
I could have done it because I had I had lots of contacts because of my other activity, producing albums and all that. I could have done that in a recording studio. It was absolutely possible, but I couldn't see myself doing this with this kind of environment. And yeah. you said something very important about somebody watching you. I mean, it's like imagining a painter or writer with somebody over
exactly.
His shoulder. It's yeah. exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
You were mentioning something very interesting about your own experience as an actor,
yeah.
being in this kind of massive production. So, and suddenly you don't have only the director in front of you, but you have three people around just checking every details of your look, of your way, of your light and all that. I mean, it's of course a total different and quite lots of pressure and yeah. quite a different environment. So I'm absolutely convinced that that couldn't happen.
Well, that's what fascinates me about early electronic music in general, is that it shifted away from being in the hands of a record label, you know, or, you know, the kind of constraints of that, i.e. being told exactly when you're going to go in record, who's going to be like, you know, sort of like producing it and that kind of thing. This was the first time that that had ever really happened. I mean, apart from the stuff in the UK, what was his name? Telstar. What was that producer called?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, he did sort of basic yeah. home recordings, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you made a whole album on your own in your kitchen.
Yeah.
Without anybody asking for it.
Oh, of course. Nobody even know. Even my publisher being involved with my work and the record, the label, they have no idea about what I was doing, because it was like a side project. But
yeah.
actually, my side project for me was a kind of priority, but it was considered as a side project elsewhere, even not a project at all, because I didn't even mention that to anybody.
Because I've always been interested in, I mean, I always think the best art for me, or the most interesting, is usually the art that no one's asked for, or no one's, you know, sort of commissioned or whatever.
Yeah.
And this definitely falls into that, doesn't it? In the way that you did this with some very basic instruments. I mean, I'm going to become sort of technical now.
Yeah, but you know, just to comment on just what you said, I think this is the beauty of the first album, the first novel, the first movie you do. Nobody is waiting for you.
Yeah.
So it's something that nobody needs,
yeah.
and something that you do just on your own. And this is a unique moment you have to enjoy in your life, because it's not going to happen again.
Yeah.
Or it's not going to happen again if it's a success or it's a hit. If it's not, it will be next time, or maybe never.
Yeah.
But the first hit is, in a sense, the best news for your life, but it's also one of the most unfortunate events, because you will lose your virginity as an unexpected act.
Yeah.
Because then after that, everybody will expect something, and most of the time, they will expecting something wrong.
Yeah.
And that's something that will not. And also the other thing is, actually, in this first project, you put all your experiences, your experimentations and your dreams since you're born. Then you reset everything after the first album, and the second one will be just your evolution and what you learned from the first one to the second one. So the period will be much, much smaller,
yeah.
to the maturation and
yeah.
the way it's evolving, the evolution of it.
Yeah, to sort of prepare for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Because this is a thing that, I mean, if people listen to Oxygen, even now, I don't think that they would realize how kind of simple in terms of instrumentation that you had. I mean, the main sound of Oxygen, the signature sound, basically comes from a home organ and a guitar pedal.
Yeah.
Would that be accurate?
Yes, and even more, even worse. 50% of the music is the delay of the on the right side on the right speaker from coming from the left speaker. It's actually 50% of the sound is coming from the delay of the original music.
Yeah.
And that actually the sound of this Eminent,
yeah,
and the Revox tape recorder creating the delay. And it's a very, very specific sound. I mean, each instrument is specific by definition, but the Revox doesn't sound at all like any other kind of delay processing or whatever. And then that's actually, so I had to synchronize the speed of the Revox instead in function of the tempo. And why the tempo of Oxygen is something that I never discussed that, but why the tempo of Oxygen is 120 or 60.
Yeah.
Is because the speed of a Revox at that moment, the Revox I had no speed variator.
Wow.
And then when you are in the regular speed of a tape recorder, the 375 or 9.5,
yeah,
or 375 inch per second is 120, is the equivalent of 120 or 60 BPM.
I didn't know that.
And,
okay.
And then the delay I used was linked, and then I was synchronized my clock or whatever on the speed of the delay to match the speed. So the tempo of my any kind of parts on Oxygen actually was dictated by the
governed
speed
by
of the govern and dictated by the speed of the delay.
I didn't know that. Well, that's fascinating. Yeah. So that's another constraint from the equipment, much like the Magnetron. And the other thing is, a teenager, I remember listening to it and I didn't understand how the hell you'd manage to sync that drum machine to the bass lines and to the sort of marimbery parts on four and all this kind of thing. So you were actually modifying bits of equipment.
Yeah, but actually for Oxygen, I simply played everything manually,
yeah,
on the drum machine.
Right, okay.
The old sequences with the mini pops, all sequences above were done manually because I couldn't sync anything in
okay.
those days. That came later on, and for Equinox, we then...
So you didn't sync the mini pops for Oxygen?
Anything.
So it's the bass lines you're playing?
Yeah, like, I was just playing, playing on it, and when it was wrong, I was going back to...
It's very impressive.
Yeah, yes, and very laborious also.
Yeah.
And also, another thing which is quite fun, talking about this really technically, on Oxygen 2, you have this sequence coming from the arpeggiator from the AKS, and it's absolutely not the same tempo as the mini pop, but it works in a sense that it's like one third of the tempo more
right.
quickly, and then it's like a random sequence, and it works mysteriously. Not that mysteriously, if you're analyzing what's going on in terms of tempo, but actually it's not synchronized, but it works.
Okay.
And then I kept it.
Yes,
I did it, and then it was really just by shifting the speed a little bit. Suddenly it was working, so I left it like this, and I recorded it once because I couldn't do it again.
Couldn't do it again. Oh, that's fascinating. The other thing that we've talked about before is the use of European organs as opposed to American organs, the Eminent being Dutch, the Farfisa Italian organ.
Yeah,
and they do have a different atmosphere, don't they?
Absolutely. It's a very, very interesting point, Matt, this, because it's coming from something that it's not said very often. And it's based on the fact that after the Second World War, because Europe was so poor, we went into all over Europe with 220 volts, where in the US it was 120.
Yeah.
It means to save the copper in all cables and wires. With 220, you could divide the amount of copper by four. This is the reason why the recordings of that time in America have this kind of very warm and fat type of sound, where the sound, and it's also made the sound of UK rock and pop. I mean, it's much dry and smaller. You take an AMS VCS3 and you take a Moog. This is exactly what the illustrations of what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I always prefer the sound of Italian, European organ, this kind of coldness and yes, coldness and having the kind of straight when you take, for instance, the Vox Continental.
Yeah.
I mean, it has this kind of dry sound that makes the sound of the doors, for instance.
Yeah.
Where the B3 Hammond would never do that.
No.
And I'd never been such a big fan of B3. I never really used it because for me it was too jazzy and too warm, too fat, taking too much range in the mix.
Yeah.
When you use that, it's so fat that you cannot really add something on it. It's very difficult. And also, because of the dryness and the coldness of these instruments, if you were putting a pedal, guitar pedal, it would work much better than on the B3.
Yeah.
And this is the reason why I used always this kind of, and I love I still have my Farfisa, and it's something that we had in common with Rick Wright. He's always played with Farfisa and organ like this. I even don't know if maybe he played a bit of Hammond, but I think he was really playing this because actually in electronic music, this is the sound, the cool sound.
Well, I mean, Philip
just
Glass,
a dry sine wave and square and triangle and not, they are not jazzy at all. They are more straight.
Yeah. Cause I first heard them with Philip Glass, maybe before hearing you. You know, the album where there's four of them all sat around playing a Farfisa.
Yeah.
And they're all going out of time with each other.
Yeah.
Totally fascinating to listen to. And then I remember listening to your Farfisa with the Electric Mistress, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really pokes through. I suppose because of the vibrato is much more sort of prominent, isn't it, on those, as opposed to being hit with a Leslie.
Basic.
Yeah.
In a sense, less sophisticated.
Yeah.
And you know, all this kind of, and also the sound of the organ sound of the Eminent, without the string ensemble type, is also very basic, close to the Farfisa. And for instance, in Oxygen Part 5, all the beginning where you have this kind of harmonics going through like this.
Yeah.
Is something that is very difficult to get. And this is really based on the Electric Mistress pedal with the sound of Eminent organ or Farfisa organ.
Yeah.
Because the sine wave are very pure. And then when you put the flanger on that, that's actually cutting, I mean, breaking the signal of the sign, and then they are going through like in a quite ghostly atmosphere, and this is really magic.
Yeah, it
and
is.
I couldn't do that with anything else even further on when I wanted to repeat this. It didn't work. It's really working with this kind of organ of that period.
Because I listened to, I think I told you last, the last time they sort of cleaned off the Good, Bad, and the Ugly soundtrack. Any of my guys, and the Farfisa really pokes through.
Oh, of course,
that
yes.
I've never heard before. Like, yeah. I mean, even like the opening track.
If you
listen, it's sort of underneath those drums. It's really atmospheric. It's such a, like you say, it's a completely different atmosphere than a B3 or other organ.
We haven't talked enough in the history of electronic music about the importance of Italian instruments.
Yeah,
I mean, we should never forget that the Stradivarius and all these fantastic instruments are Italian. So the Italian have very, as we know, a very organic relationship with sounds. And then all these cheap organs, or as we call cheap organs or cheap instruments,
yeah.
I mean, are really part of the history of electronic music. And if you take the Synthex Elka Synthex, it's certainly even the best sound for an analog polyphonic synthesizer. It's way better than the Memory Moog or whatever, even if I love the Memory Moog as an instrument. But Synthex is absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
And they just did 50 in the world, you know?
Yeah.
Because they
and you've got three.
Yes, so yes, the 47 are out there, left.
Yeah. And there's the other thing as well, the really obscure
Stevie Wonder thing. Has two, I think.
Yeah, David Arnold's got one.
Yeah.
I saw that the other day.
Yeah.
But, and then there's that really odd looking thing that I've never seen anywhere apart from with photographs of you, is that Eco drum machine thing.
Yeah.
Italian again. Right?
Italian again, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And very interesting because it was like with this kind of card, like the first computer card, where you put holes in a card. Is like this kind of street organ. But it's funny that actually the early computers, are copying the process of street organs with cardboard and holes, rectangle holes. And then you were able to create your own rhythm by just
punching.
Yeah. But also, I lost all these cards at a very early stage. And then you have no, because that was to keep your presets and to keep your things. So I used it just live.
That's right.
And it has a very specific sound because, of course, drum machines are also an old story on themselves. And it's very important in my case, I mean, drum machines have always been very, very important. The sounds of them, the Mini Pops or the KF-55 for Equinox. And these are really key instruments. We are talking about Eminent, but the Mini Pops also is very important in Oxygen, in the sound of Oxygen.
Yeah, sure. So it's released and it's massive. As an album.
After having been rejected by...
Sure, so it's on an independent label first that doesn't do it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. So tell me, so what were the excuses not to release it when you first gave it to...
Because you have no drums, no singer, and also each part is too long for single, for radio, and on top of it, I'm French.
Oh wow! Okay,
from an international,
yeah,
rock. You know, it was. You have to remember that it was in days where John Lennon was saying that the level of French rock music is at the level of English wine.
Right? Did he say that?
Yes.
Oh God.
Okay. So fortunately, we got our revenge later on.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, he didn't see it.
No. All right, I didn't know that either. Yeah, so it's turned down for those reasons.
Yes.
And then you take it to...
Dreyfus, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I was already in deal with him, but then we actually wanted to have an international release, and it was really hard. And then he took it internationally, and then in my life, thanks to the UK... a few times, because Radio 1 picked it up.
Like Simon May, wasn't it?
And he played the entire album one night.
Right.
And then that was the beginning of it. And then Polydor took the album worldwide. It became an instant hit all over the world, very fast, very quickly. And I still have somewhere the charts in Europe, and where it has been released, and it was really... popular is in summer 77 when, I mean, Elvis died. And I remember that Oxygen was number one, and after you had seven albums of Elvis.
Oh.
So it, in a lifetime, being a massive Elvis fan, it was really an achievement.
Yeah. That is incredible. So Polydor made the decision on the back of it being played on Radio 1. In the UK,
yeah,
they took it on.
I mean, it came from Radio 1 as usual. You don't, as you know, even now. I mean, from you don't dictate anything to Radio 1. They pick up what they want to pick, and they said, "Ah, that's fun. Let's do that." And actually, ironically, very popular radio stations called Europe Number One, Europe Number One in France, did the same thing.
Right.
They played the entire album as well, more or less the same week. It's a bit earlier on. And then it created the same kind of phenomenon. It's quite rare because they, I mean, radio stations, even Radio 1, they didn't play the entire album a lot. I know that they did it for Dark Side of the Moon, I think.
Yeah.
But not for lots of albums. I mean, so it was quite an event.
Yeah. Okay. So the time of it going to the sort of top of the charts from when you start to record Equinox, had you been doing sort of preparation for the follow-up album when you finished Oxygen?
You know, this is the that every recording artist know is the nightmare of the second album, where you suddenly you have a massive hit, and then you have lots of new friends and lots of pressure, and suddenly lots of people are interested by what you're doing, and the same people were even not knowing you and having no clue about what you were. Who you were,
yeah,
just a few months before. So, and for Equinox, then my challenge was to develop the idea I had by actually in terms of structure, in terms of arrangement. So it took me one entire to do the second one on 16 tracks.
Yeah.
So I dubbed, I still did the Equinox in the same, within the same conditions. It's the reason
the
why
same
it's so
kitchen.
Close. The same kitchen.
Yeah.
Just the color is it's quite funny because in my life, I just divorced during Oxygen. And then in the flat, my ex-wife at that time, I mean, she took absolutely everything including the handles and bulbs and everything. And it was all black. It was, you know, this kind of brilliant black. The old flat, the old apartment was black. And I just had huge tennis shoes that was like a bed. You know, these days it was like a bed. I could sleep. I was sleeping in this kind of giant tennis shoe.
Yeah.
And then people went to this apartment to listen to Oxygen at the beginning. I mean, media people and all that. And they were coming into this apartment, all black, empty, just with the tennis shoe. And then, with Charlotte, the mother of my kids, we lived in this apartment. We painted everything in white. And then we decided to move outside, actually close to this studio. And then we moved, but I was finishing Equinox. So then the apartment was still empty because we moved in a different place. And then the same people came 2 years later and saw the same apartment, all white.
Yeah.
The same, everything empty, still with a tennis shoe as a bed. And it was quite interesting to see their faces.
Yeah.
And then the Equinox, actually, I did it still in the same situation, just with a little more equipment. But it's the reason why that it's quite linked to Oxygen in terms of sound. But I think that looking back and having worked recently on this new album linked to Oxygen, I think I succeeded to do what I wanted to do by making Oxygen more sophisticated and in terms of arrangement and having actually starting to synchronize sequences. So it was a big relief.
Yeah.
And being able to synchronize the drum machine as well at the same time. So it has been a long, long process to try to find the right pace.
Yeah. So is that kitchen still there? Is that apartment still there?
No. Yeah. It's somewhere, but I think it has been, I moved into, outside Paris, close to where we are today and, in a house. And then I left the apartment to a very funny guy. He was a stand-up comedian, French stand-up comedian.
Right.
And he transformed this kitchen into a kind of Greek-Roman bathroom, totally crazy. So this kitchen became a recording studio and then a total time of kitsch kind of bathroom afterwards, which I quite like.
Yeah, yeah.
as an idea.
And is that what it is now? Is it still?
I don't know
bathroom?
Because that was a long time ago. That I think no, because this guy, very funny guy, actually passed away, and I know it has. And then the apartment.
It's been sold.
Yeah, I don't know.
This would be quite interesting. Whoever's in there, whether they.
Yeah, it's a good idea. I should go back there and just.
Yeah.
Bring it just to check where.
Yeah, it's quite an important space.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. So the equipment is slightly more sophisticated and you've got an idea of what you want to do for this follow-up album, would you say?
I don't know. I suppose that I had this discussion with some artists that the first album you do and being successful is sometimes quite mysterious the way you do it. And when I listened, and I remember when I was listening to the side one of the vinyl of Oxygen, there is a kind of quite magic balance in all this. I mean, everything is quite smooth and quite logical. And I did it almost in a kind of unconscious way, just by playing and doing experimenting. And then I said for the second one, I really would like to go deeper in the fact that the parts should not be felt as part with a transition, but like a continuous mix.
Right.
And then that being conscious of this, it became much more difficult than having done that by chance, more or less.
Yeah.
So that took me much more time. And also the concept of Oxygen was, of course, based on the concept of air, ethereal and air, where Equinox, I decided that Equinox would be more aquatic and more wet and more linked with more liquid in the sense of the approach of natural sounds or processed sounds. After Oxygen, between Oxygen and Equinox, I met Fellini, and he told me two very important things in my life. It was just, I met him at Cannes Festival, and actually Nino Rota passed away, and he was going to do his last movie, and he asked me to do the soundtrack for that. And I said I couldn't, because Nino Rota is so important in my life, and the collaboration between those two, I mean, I was not feeling that I could be was able to do it. I regret it after to have said no, but actually it was not too much of a regret, because unfortunately Fellini passed away just after, so it happened. But the two things he told me about was, first of all, he said, you know, in my life I always thought that I was doing a new movie, and I realized at the end of my life that I always did the same one, just a declination of the same process, which I think is true for any artist.
Yeah.
And the second thing, he said, you know, I hate realism. And for instance, for me, if I want the sea and the beach, I'm going to recreate the sea in studio with drapes and veils and fans and painting, because I think my view of the sea is more important than the real one. And that really rang a bell in my mind, because it's exactly what I like in electronic music. And then, for instance, all the sounds of waves and in Oxygen, for instance, even in Equinox in some moment, even if I mix a bit of natural sounds processed, are actually recreation, my view of the sound of the waves and birds.
The seagulls, really, yeah.
Yes, yeah. The seagulls that I entirely did with the ARP 2600,
yeah.
Instead of having real ones. I could have used real recordings, but it was much more poetic for me and much more interesting to recreate them, because then it's like painting. It's like recreating something fake.
Mm.
But I mean, fake sometimes is, I mean, art is all about fake elements.
Yeah.
And these fake elements are giving you another view of reality.
Yeah.
And this is what also is really behind the Equinox a lot. This idea of imitating, in a sense, also classical instrument, but not like we talked about before with the preset and the X7, but just finding things that make you culturally think about instruments being familiar, but they're not exactly that. And that was one of the ideas for the arrangement for Equinox.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back in the studio with Jean-Michel Jarre next week for another episode.